This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Bill Rohrbach is the author of many books of fiction and nonfiction, including his novels The Remedy for Love and Life Among Giants. One of his story collections, Big Bend, won both the Flannery O'Connor and O. Henry prizes. His work has been featured in Harper's, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and was one of NPR's selected shorts. I caught up with him recently through Skype at his home in Maine, and we spoke about his new collection of stories, The Girl of the Lake. I'm Beth Goulet, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. When you do interviews about stories, it's a little bit more difficult because, I mean, I did not read them in order, so that's another thing I want to ask you about. When you have stories that are selected to go in books, are they intended to be read in that order, or was I messing something up by jumping around?
No, you know, I think there are books that are. I think there's books of stories that are linked, that are kind of halfway to being novels where it makes a difference, maybe, but these stories I've written over many years, kind of in the interstices of making novels and nonfiction. When it came time to put them all in a basket, which is what I did, I put a whole bunch of stories, maybe 20, in a basket and then tried to see which ones fit and which ones didn't. About 10 came out and the rest are the book. And the order is just was kind of a feeling of flow, but I always read out of order, so I always feel sorry for myself carefully putting them in order, because I know almost no one reads them that way. I always look for the shortest one, and then I read that first, and then pick out titles that sound good to me, so I'm a kind of bad reader that way. But I think the way we did it, one thing I thought of was to alternate first person and third person, so that when you finished a first-person story, you wouldn't start another first-person story with a little confusion in your head about who's talking now that the character has changed, you know. Other than that, it was just a matter of a sense of flow.
Now, you have four books of fiction, and are they all novels? The Remedy for Love, Life Among Giants, The Smallest Color, and Big Bend. Are those all novels?
Big Bend is a collection of stories.
Okay.
That was the collection that won the Flannery O'Connor Prize back in 2000, I think. So those stories, you know, that book collected stories written in the late 80s and 90s. And so now I'm into the next couple of decades.
How does an author determine if a story should remain a short story or if it should be continued on and fleshed out into a novel? Or do you just keep writing and then try to determine if you just have to keep going? Or maybe I should trim this back and it would make a better story?
No, you know, I never start out thinking, I'm not sure which it is. I'm always know I'm writing a story or I'm writing a novel. They're just so different in approach. And in, you know, the psychic space that you need as you sit down to start a novel, it's just a different thing. I think my novel starts tend to be a little grander and have more of the place in them and more time for the character to speak and be present. Whereas a short story, you got to bang, you got to get in there, and there need to be fewer characters and a more limited time frame most of the time, although a lot of my stories are really vast time frames and lots of characters. So I'm probably just going to contradict everything I say because I don't think there's any one way I do it.
There was one story that confused me somewhat, and it was Some Should. And it confused me because, okay, it was about two characters who were going on a date. They had met through an internet dating service. She worked a farm and he was an Episcopal priest. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
But she wouldn't...
She owned a farm somewhere in Michigan.
Yes.
And they're both on two dating sites. And one of them was this sort of snuggly, cute dating site. And the other one was this sort of salacious, sexy site. And she spots this priest on both and just thought, well, that's interesting, you know. So what's the confusion? I'm confused too, by the way, so this will be great.
My confusion was, you know, whenever he would ask her name, she would spit out another name and another name and another name. And he could always tell when she was lying. I'm still not exactly sure what her name was. Because, you know, even when she would say Francis and it's really Francis, or Ellen and it's really Ellen. But then Jaden, a name she had thrown out earlier, Jaden would say something. And was that just one of her personas speaking, or the way she was talking to him? And I don't know. It was very clever.
I think what's going on is she just doesn't trust him, you know, and she's not even sure she should believe he's a priest. And then she's also encountering her own sneakiness, you know, so that it's really she who's the one who's telling lies and not being her true self. So there's a little bit of that. So I guess that would be confusing. And I think her real name comes out toward the end, and he finally believes her. And it's right at the moment where they're dropping all pretense and heading for her house, which is like an hour and a half away from where they had a date. So it's a real commitment, you know. So I don't know. Yeah, she's confusing, but I think she's just being canny and maybe overly so.
Well, and I loved the title of that short story, because they were talking about Episcopal confession. With Episcopalians, it was, all may, some should, none must. And so the name of the story was Some Should. And it ended up being a, you know, this first date was a confessional experience for both of them.
Yeah, I like the way they, and this always, these things come as a surprise to me, you know, so I'm allowed to say I like it because it's kind of what happened to them, you know, but I like the way they make these confessions to each other that are, you know, they're just laying their cards on the table. It's like, here, this is who I really am. And if you are still interested after I tell you this pretty startling story, then we're good, you know. And I had the impression that the priest hadn't been out on any dates yet. So he was forgetting that you're not supposed to tell everyone everything in the first minute, whereas she'd done quite a few and was being extra cautious. So he took her by surprise too. And I think, again, probably excited her mistrust with this story. And yet the story drew her in to who he was.
I love the way you would wrap them up quite nicely. You know, I'm thinking of Harbinger Hall.
Harbinger Hall.
Oh, God, I love that. I just loved that. The whole idea. And see, am I supposed to give any of these things away? You'll have to tell me if I've done any spoilers that I need to cut out.
Well, I think there's anything about sex is a really good spoiler, because that will interest people. And mostly, and that story has like zero sex in it, so I don't know why I brought it up for this story. But yeah, I think spoilers are kind of actually seductive, you know, so I don't mind. Go ahead and give them all away. Let's read the endings of all the stories.
Okay.
then the suspense becomes not what happens, but how does it happen? How do you get there? So I don't think spoilers are the worst thing in the world, generally. Although the way they build these TV shows now, they can really ruin your day. You know?
So. Well, that one I did actually read first. It was the first one in the book, and I read it first. Uh-huh. And, you know, this young boy, was he, now I'm, oh, he was in sixth grade. Yeah, it says it in the first sentence. He was sick of sixth grade and decided to type a note to his teacher saying that his family was moving away. And he would have these adventures. I got the feeling, did it last about a week that he was able to, you know, not go to school and skip the bus? And
I think a little longer than that, maybe okay. 10 days. He was a little bit protective. And it was, you know, it was taking place in the 60s, the era before safety. You know, there were no seat belts, and, you know, you left the house in the morning on a summer's day and all you had to do was be back by dinner. And my parents never asked me what I was doing, you know, like I could do anything and I could walk for miles, which I would do. So this kid is just in his era, and when you could write a note to your teacher saying your family's moving away And she's like, oh, how sad. Okay, we'll miss you. And then he just stops going to school. I think it's a pretty good setup. Then he crosses paths with this elderly man who at first he and the reader are very suspicious of, but who proves to be a big factor in his life.
It was fantastic. And it was one of those stories where you finished it and you thought, oh, if only that could have happened to me. I should have skipped school in sixth grade and found somebody to.
I used to just spend all my time in the woods, and there was this somewhat broke down mansion, maybe a mile through the woods behind our house. So I would walk over there and just kind of spy on the place. I never interacted with the guy, although I spotted him occasionally. So this is just a way of saying, what if I had met the guy? What would have happened? And that's where a lot of stories start for me, is taking something that was kind of like what I did and then making the gesture that I would never make out of caution or whatever. So I wouldn't go on a date with an Episcopalian priest an hour and a half away. But what if I did, you know? So,
well, what other stories in this book were like that for you? Like Murder Cottage, did that have any real life, you know?
I think that's the funniest title. Just for some reason, it gets to me. Murder Cottage was like, I was looking at houses, and just one of the houses I looked at had this huge, obscene stain on a carpet downstairs, and it just looked murdery to me. But it totally turned me off to the house. I was like, no way I want that. Then you move from there to, well, like, what if the house was so great that even though there had been a crime there, you just thought you better get it, you know? So that's where that came from, I think. Also, I wanted a little shorter, lighter story, and that story is a comedy, you know, so.
How do you choose which of the stories becomes the title of the book? How do you decide, you know, The Girl at the Lake was the last story in the book, and that is the name of the collection of stories.
Yeah, I just found that very evocative. I love asking people, as people read the book, what was your favorite story? Because it's always different, and it's seldom the story that's my favorite story. Not that I have favorites among my children, but I do happen to like this story a lot because it contains a message, a positive message for the future in a way. So I just like that. But that's not how it becomes the title of the whole collection. The whole collection, if you picked, let's say you picked Murder Cottage, that would be terribly misleading for this book. And yet, you know, it has its own evocation. If you picked Harbinger Hall, some should would just be confusing, you know. So you go through and The Girl of the Lake is the one title that fit every story in a certain way. So every story you could go into and tell me where the girl of the lake is in this story, because there's always a young woman and there's often a body of water. It's not specific, but it fits. It can fit each story in one way or another. So it's a little more cohesive. It holds things together in a different way. Also, I just love the idea of that adolescent summer's day feeling, you know. So somehow that story really called to me. And someone was saying to me that they're like, oh, there's all these books with girl in the title. It's like it's all a rage, you know. And you just like trying to tap into like Girl on the Train and all. She's listed like 12 titles. I'd heard of most of them, but not all of them. So then I looked on Goodreads and I just typed in books with girl in the title. And there was 680 something books with girl in the title. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, there's probably, you know, millions with the in the title. So you just can't win, you know. Or lake, you could look up lake and find probably hundreds of books, you know. I just thought of In the Lake of the Woods, that great Tim O'Brien book. So I don't know. I don't think you're ever going to get off easy with your title.
Well, I hadn't even thought about the girl and the lake appearing in all of the stories, but that is fascinating now that I'm listening to it. Did you have a summer house experience like Chick? Because you've always lived in the northeastern part of the United States, correct?
Yes, my family, we always had a cabin on a lake in New Hampshire, a more modest holding than what Chick's grandparents had. They had a lot of land and a modest cabin. We just had a modest little place, family place. In New England, you call them camps. So we had a little camp on Lake Mascoma, and we went there for 30 years. And at first, it was my siblings in high school and college. And then later, as we started having kids, it became a real central meeting place. And all the children, all the grandchildren, cousins would all be together. It was so fun. And now, you know, they're all getting grown up too. And my father's 90. My mother's passed away. And it was just time. My father needed funds. So my older brother and I went up there and cleaned it up and sold it to the neighbor all in a couple of days. It was very emotional to let go of that place. And that happened after I wrote the story in the book, but I think I was already able to picture those emotions, you know. And the story, maybe one of the reasons it's one of my favorites, is, you know, the boy, the young man, gets to keep the place. It's going to be his place with his own girl of the lake. So he solves the sad problem of family legacy.
I loved the way that, you know, all of the other siblings and all of the other cousins were able to find something else to do that summer. And somehow he was the one who was going to go spend the summer with grandma who had just lost her husband. And when she said, "I bought you an island," I just thought, oh, thank God.
Yeah. She works out this. She's, you know, she's this little, you know, sweet, fluffy grandma, you know, smells nice. And then underneath you see her just working her magic to cut out all the people who aren't appreciating the place for what it is and to reward Chick for loving it. Which is, in writ large, is, you know, the whole planet. It's like, let's let the meek inherit the earth already.
I'm visiting with Bill Rohrbach via Skype about his new book, The Girl of the Lake, and it's a book of stories from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. We are friends on Facebook.
And friends at martini bars in Wichita, Kansas, which was so fun.
Well, on Facebook, you post a lot of images that you've taken, I'm assuming from around your house, different wildflowers or frozen lakes. You know, is that just part of your daily routine?
They certainly are part of my writing process. My engagement with nature is, I'm trying to get it to all be one thing somehow, which I know is unlikely, but I'm getting closer. Back in the day, I would get up, take a walk in the forest for an hour or 2 hours, something like that. And then I would land at my desk at a pre-decided time. And I think it would be like 10 o'clock. With a good walk or working in the garden, I would arrive at my desk really ready to write. I would have sentences just coming out of me. So I just realized I could count walking or gardening as writing, because I was organizing my thoughts and pushing down the thoughts that aren't useful, all the daily stuff, you know, all the logistics we're all always dealing with. And then I would write till 1:30, I remember, and then I would have lunch, and then I would have a nap, and then I would write from 3 to 6. I would do that every day in the summer, you know, when I wasn't teaching. When I was teaching, I'd figure out some way to, you know, approximate that, or, you know, find time to take a walk. I'd ride my bike to school or something like that. But then we had a kid, and that just blew up my whole schedule just changed completely. And here she's 16 now, and slowly moving out into the world the way kids do. What I'm finding is that because of you know, the way my schedule was for so long, our family schedule, I got good at writing in 10-minute increments, or, you know, drop the girl at ballet, drive over to the library, I would have 45 minutes and just write, and then go pick her up and go get ice cream and go home. And then I'd have 10 minutes before I had to make dinner, or before the next thing, whatever it might be. And I would just say, okay, I'm going to take these 10 minutes and work on this thing. So, and I also started working late at night. So everyone would go to bed. My wife is an early to bed person, and my daughter is a little less early to bed, but I would just get her in bed by 10 or so. And then I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning, writing and daydreaming. And, that way I'd preserve my hour in the woods. You asked about the woods. I try to make sure I spend at least an hour, outdoors every day, and usually much more. And try to walk miles if possible, and just really observe and look for stuff. And taking pictures focuses my attention quite a bit. I also have my binoculars, so I'm always examining things. And I love the binoculars. It's like I can have these days where I'm so inside my head and so, you know, sort of tangled up in my thoughts and my day and my logistics. And I'll look through the binoculars, and somehow it projects my consciousness out into the world, into the trees, you know, in a way that actually just ends those thought cycles that we all get into, you know. So I just find nature vital to what I do. And yeah, so what you're seeing is stuff from my backyard, basically. But my backyard, we're in Maine, and we're in western Maine. It's pretty isolated. It's pretty rural. And so my backyard is everyone else's backyard, but there's just, you know, thousands of acres back there to walk around in, adjacent to my 6 acres. So I take advantage of the common space, which I'm very happy is still available here.
As you write, you know, you said you know if you're writing a short story, or you know if you're working on a novel. Do you ever have, you know, a lot of just thoughts spinning at once, or are you a one story at a time type of person where you write until it's done and then move on to the next?
No, I'm always have several things going, just the way I read too. So I, you know, next to my bed, I'll have 11 books open to various depths, you know, in a stack. And yeah, I'll keep visiting the ones that are staying in my head. It's just like that with my own work. So stories will, sometimes I'll start them, get a few good pages, and then it'll sit for 5 years. I mean, really 5 years. And then one day I'll have time to work on something. I'll say, what should I work on today? And then I'll remember, what about that? I remember that there was something about this guy and his friend going to Ibiza. What was that? And I go find it. And on that day, it might take off. It might interest me on that day, and I'll finish a very rough draft. My style is to speed through a rough draft, and even have like brackets where I just say, "Here's where they go to town and do the X, Y, Z," and then continue forward. So then my revision self comes back, and my revision self is always frustrated with my rough draft self for not doing more work. it's like, you lazy rough draft self, you know, now I have to sit here and do this, you know. So the revision self works on it, and it's not very good, but then so that gets put away for a while, and then you come back around again, and now it's that much better, and the effort makes it even that much better. And it's like you can write smarter than you actually are, because all these selves are coming back to it and building from progress. So I'll be working on that story and a novel and a nonfiction project and a book review and an essay and various interviews. And just each day and each week, I kind of think, what's important this week? So for the last several weeks, what's been important has been the novel I'm working on. So I've really been focused on that very intently, knowing that this new book tour is coming up and that I'm going to be massively distracted. So I thought maybe I can get this draft done, get it to my reading group, and that is my novel group of friends who reread each other's work, then they can work on it for a month, and I can do my tour and stuff before I come back to it.
I wanted to ask one more thing about, you know, the whole process of the short story, because a lot of these stories that are in this book have appeared in different magazines, Atlantic Monthly or Playboy or Missouri Review. And once the story is published in those literary magazines or literary publications, you never alter them when they go into the book form then, right?
Oh, no, you definitely alter them. Yeah, so Atlantic published Harbinger Hall. I forget what year, but it's a while back. It's one of the earliest stories that's in the book. And I worked with Michael Curtis. He's brilliant. What a great editor. But they have severe space limitations in that magazine and in many. So he said, I'm cutting these pages and this character, not because I don't love him and what happens here, but we just don't have room for it. And it does not hurt the story to pull it out. So when it came time to do the book, I'm going to put that back in. So I go find a draft where I have that bit, put it back in, read it, and say, in some cases I might say, no, that doesn't, he was right. That was really expendable. In the case of Harbinger Hall, there was a section that I felt it really worked, and the story loved having it. So I changed that. So all of them have been touched by editors, or nearly all of them. So then my book editor, Kathy Pores at Algonquin, who's quite brilliant, she reads the stories as if they're absolutely fresh, new drafts for her. And she had a lot of suggestions. I don't take every single one, but mostly I do. A lot of the suggestions did have to do with expanding certain moments, because in the book you'd have more room for that, you know. So, yeah, they change a lot. And, it is a funny feeling because you feel like your publication, you've shut the door on it. But, no, you can keep going. And a lot of writers have done this. But, you know, Montaigne with his essays, he was writing those until the day he died, revising and revising, even though they'd been published sometimes in five different places in five different forms. He just kept working on them and working on them. I like that idea that as long as I'm alive, the stories are still potentially mutable, you know. But I've never done anything like where you go, okay, he died in the original story in the magazine, but I'm going to make him live, you know. That's something, though, that they do for television and movies sometimes. When a really famous book, everyone knows what happens. It's hard to have the proper suspense for your television series or your movie, so they'll just go ahead and change what happens, like sometimes drastically, and sometimes to great complaint from devotees to the book, like the Game of Thrones fans, the book fans, are often up in arms about what happens in the television series. But I think it's exciting that it's a mutable world. It's like so unlike ours, where stuff happens, and that's what happened. But in fiction, you can change what happened. It's kind of cool.
I find this absolutely fascinating, because I was just under the impression that once you said, okay, this is it, it's going to publication, it was like, done.
Yeah, there's some that are very close to what was in the original magazine version, but some that are quite different. You know, I think it takes a certain hubris to think, I got that one right, and just stop there, you know? I think there's almost no novelist who wouldn't change her book if given the opportunity 100 years later, you know?
Yeah.
So. But then I always remember reading the Magus, how do you say that? The John Fowles book, so mysterious and so hard to understand what happened. And then 20 years later, he did a revision of it and published it. It was very exciting, a big publishing event. I bought it, hoping I'd finally get the answers to all the mysteries, because he has revised it, but it just got more mysterious. I don't know what he was changing. You know, it was such a disappointment. I'm sure all my changes were really useful to these stories. And one day some student will read the magazine version and the book version and tell me what the differences are. Oh, and here's an awesome thing is that I had a story called Big Bent in the Atlantic. It had to be pared down, similar fashion. Atlantic published it, and then it was in Best Stories of the South or something, and it was in it won an O'Henry Prize. So it was in the O'Henry Prize collection. And I asked the editor of the Best Stories of the South, could I add some stuff back in that we had to cut? And she's like, oh, no, we better not do that. In fact, oddly, that editor is my editor at Algonquin now. That's how I met her. But the editor at the Story Prize, the O'Henry Prize, was like, yeah, we could add back that section. That'd be fine. So then that was another version. And then Selected Shorts picked it up, the NPR show. That used to be on Sunday nights here. I don't know if it's still around. And I flew out to Getty Center, and James Cromwell was the actor who read it, and he was fantastic. It was wonderful. But what they did, it was the only story they ever did that took the entire show, and they had to make it fit. So they called me at some point and said, we need more material. I mean, is there any way? And I go, yeah, I do have more material, because they cut some stuff. So I sent them that, and they got it to just exactly the 50 minutes they needed, or whatever the length was, I'm forgetting. And the actor and the director, Iroh, what's his name? They rebuilt the story into a script. And I watched it, and I came up. They called me up on stage afterwards at the Getty Center in Los Angeles. And I got up on stage, and I'm shaking James Cromwell's hand, you know, who's one of my favorite actors. He's very tall. And he says, and I'm really nervous. And he says, how was that? Was that okay? Are you mad that we changed it? with the crowd clapping and everything. I was like, no, it was great. And then I put it in my book, in my collection, which won the Flannery O'Connor Prize. That story in the collection's even longer than the Selected Shorts version. So there's four or five versions of that same story that all had their own kind of success.
That was Bill Rohrbach, author of The Girl of the Lake, which was published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new interviews at kmuw.org or on iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.